Belgrade's president upon arrival from Russia says Tehran and Moscow have reached major agreements and decided to increase their trade volume to $10 billion annually. U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating falls to its lowest level of his presidency as he begins his second year in office. Plus, Asian share markets and U.S. futures tumble on Friday after U.S. stocks took a dive overnight. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who just got back from Russia, has spoken about major achievements accomplished by a delegation he led on his two-day trip to Moscow.
During this trip, there has been a key agreement for expanding multilateral, sustainable, and beneficial relations between the two countries. Undoubtedly, the expanding of bilateral ties with Russia will contribute to the security and welfare of both nations.
Raisi said talks with top Russian officials were in line with the Islamic Republic's foreign policy goals. He said the two countries can keep on their trade and banking relations based on their national currencies and break the dominance of the U.S. dollar. Raisi added the two countries have decided to increase trade volume to $10 billion annually. He further said that Tehran and Moscow have agreed to expand oil and gas fields and exchange-related technologies. The Iranian president said that cooperation in agriculture, transportation, and defense were also discussed. Raisi expressed optimism that such cooperation will help it bring about security, peace, and stability to the region. Negotiations are still underway in the Austrian capital, Vienna, between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran deal. While European and American diplomats have expressed concerns about the slow pace of talks, Iran says an agreement is within reach if the U.S. removes sanctions in a verifiable manner and gives assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Homo Lesgi has your story out of Vienna.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrico Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the U.S. will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration."
Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
U.S. President Joe Biden took office last year with a handful of promises to the American people and the world, but he's already failed to deliver on a number of them. A simple glance at Biden's approval rating indicates that his popularity has kept falling since January of 2021, and if you're interested to know the reason, this report may give you some insight.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst-hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions, while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor Trump had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet, affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August. Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
I'm making it clear.
Joining us now from Irvine, California, for more on the story is Mr. Paul Sheldon Foote, professor at Cal State University there. Hello, Professor Foote. Always a pleasure to have you on. Your thoughts on things. So gas and food prices, you know, basically out of control, Russia tensions, stuff that's really not great for a first year as a president. 43% by some polls, a lot lower by other polls. Your thoughts why 57% got to 43% in less than 12 months for the U.S. president?
Well, the list is very long. For example, he campaigned claiming that he would unite America. He said, "I've had decades of experience working with Republicans. I love Republicans." He's a pathological liar. A few days ago in Georgia, made a speech in which he suggested his political opponents are traitors and racists. That's even worse than Hillary Clinton's campaign speech, where she called half of Americans deplorables. The fact is, he hates half of America, and we know it. Inflation, as you suggested, is massive thanks to deficit spending, more and more programs, government regulations hampering business and supply chain. He's senile. Everyone knew that. They voted for him anyway. He goes to press conferences when he has a few of them, and he starts talking. He has no idea what he's answering. He doesn't work very much. He spends most of his weekends in Delaware, the least working president I can think of. He loves to threaten war with Russia. Crime in America is unprecedented right now. You have companies closing stores because Democrats will not prosecute criminals. This is unheard of. Open borders. Massive illegal immigration numbers coming into this country because he wants it to happen. Very, very unpopular. These are just a few items of what it's like, not to mention his vice president is incompetent. Of all the people he could have selected, he selected someone who got knocked out of the Democratic primaries very early and wasn't even popular among the Democrats.
And Professor Foote, I mean, you mentioned the fact that he promised he's going to try to unite the country. He's having a very difficult time doing that. He's having a difficult time uniting his own party. He has two holdouts. He's got two pieces of legislation, the voting rights legislation, his social policy reform. They're all held up because he cannot even unite his own Democratic Party at this point.
Well, that's correct, because the leaders are members of the lunatic left, so-called progressives, who want to swing the country far left and basically redistribute money, steal it from taxpayers to give it to their crony friends. And there are a few Democrats, thank heavens, who don't support that, who say, this is no way, we're not going to destroy future generations of Americans by massive spending and destroying the dollar, destroying the economy, and destroying everything for the next generations. Thank heavens there are a few good ones left in the Democratic Party. Not too many, but there are a few.
Okay, and due to his lackluster performance, his leadership in the perspective of a lot of Americans at this point, according to these polls, Professor, your thoughts, once his party takes some heavy hits as a result of this in the midterms, what does that do further for his popularity as president?
Oh, it'll continue to worsen. Traditionally in this country and in the off years, the other party comes back and makes great gains anyway, but it'll make it even harder for him to push through this far-left agenda of tax and spend.
All right, Professor. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you on and hear from you. Professor Paul Sheldon Foote there joining us out of Cal State University, California. Meanwhile, Asian markets have fallen following drops in U.S. stocks and tumbles in the oil market. Japan's Nikkei slid 1.6%. Outside the country, the MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares was down 0.8%. Chinese shares plunged as well. Hong Kong benchmark lost 0.24%. Chinese blue chips lost 0.5%. Also in Asia, in trading, U.S. futures dropped, with NASDAQ losing over 1%. NASDAQ dropped inside the U.S. as well, closing 1.3% lower. Dow Jones Industrial Average, as well as the S&P 500, also slid. U.S. stocks are under pressure because the Federal Reserve is shifting policy to a tightening mode focused on tackling inflation. Concerns over the Fed's monetary policy also resulted in oil prices drops Thursday. At least four civilians are killed in the latest airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Warplanes bombed Yemen's key port city of Hodeidah, targeting a communications building and nearby sports complex. 17 people are also injured. Children are said to be making up most of the casualties. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the United Arab Emirates, have stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks. This comes after the Yemeni army successfully hit targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia with drones and missiles. The Yemeni army and its allied popular forces have also achieved major gains in ground battles against Emirati and Saudi-backed mercenaries.
On Monday, Yemen's military launched retaliatory attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates using drones and missiles to strike strategic targets in the UAE. Yemeni forces targeted a strategic oil facility and a fire at Abu Dhabi's international airport. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks against targets in Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen. But attacks against the UAE, which is fighting alongside Saudi Arabia, has been rare. It's widely believed that the attacks made UAE officials realize their vulnerabilities. The attacks are the greatest damage to the reputation of the UAE because they have always portrayed themselves as a safe and secure country to do business. Yemeni officials have warned they could target more facilities in the UAE. The years-long war on Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and pushed the country towards humanitarian catastrophe.
The support that Israel has given the UAE is important to Israel to oppose Iran. Israel considers Iran its mortal enemy. It wants to challenge Iran's power in the region.
Following the retaliatory strikes, Israel offered security and intelligence support to the United Arab Emirates. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said the regime is committed to working closely with the UAE against Yemeni forces. He also ordered the Israeli establishment to provide their counterparts in the UAE with any assistance.
The United Arab Emirates is still involved in the Yemen war, even though it's announced its withdrawal 2 years ago. Yet it is closely working with Israel in southern and coastal regions of Yemen, specifically in Socotra Island. It's reported the UAE is setting up an espionage den for Israel in Socotra. Israeli cooperation can now involve the regime's wider military participation in the conflict. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here is Ayah 31 and 32 of Surah Tur.
قل تربصوا فإني معكم من المتربصين أم تأمرهم أحلامهم بهذا أم هم قوم طاغون.
Say, O Prophet to the disbelievers, wait, I too am waiting along with you. Is it their intellect which prompts them to say this, or are they a rebellious lot? Remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said it is the habit of the disbelievers to try to belittle the prophets of God by calling them names and accusing them of madness or being fanciful poets in a vain bid to prevent people from being guided to the path of God. In their blind enmity, the pagans of Arabia, desirous of seeing the end of Islam, wished harm and used to say that they were awaiting a fatal accident for Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God, the Almighty Protector, however, made their devilish plots go awry. Thus, as is clear by the ayah that we recited to you now, the Lord Most High commands the Prophet to tell the intransient disbelievers to wait and see the terrible results of their evil for themselves, since he himself is awaiting whatever divine providence has decided for him of the two excellent things, that is, either victory over them or martyrdom in the path of God. The next ayah refers to the chiefs of the pagan Arabs who imagined that they were persons of reason and intelligence in opposition to the logic of the Prophet. It addresses all those who regard themselves as reasonable and knowledgeable, asking them whether the reason and intelligence leads them to deny the manifest truth, when it is clear that such denial stands against reason. All this means the deniers of truth are nothing but a rebellious and disobedient lot, since the reason only follows their evil desires. From this ayah we learn that, number one, patience and the passing time make the results manifest, whether these are the benefits for the truthful or the terrible fate of the deniers of the manifest truth. Number two, intelligence is the gift of God and should be used in a proper way to ascertain the truth rather than make it follow vain desires on the pretext of possessing knowledge and reason, since real reasoning never goes against reality and facts. Number 3. It is disobedience of the rationality of divine commandments that turns the deniers of truth into rebels against logic and real reasoning of the prophets. Now we present you ayahs 33 and 34 of the same surah.
أَمْ يَقُولُونَ تَقَوَّلَهُ بَلْ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ فَلْيَأْتُوا بِحَدِيثٍ مِثْلِهِ إِنْ كَانُوا صَادِقِينَ
Do they say he has improvised it? Rather, they have no faith. Let them bring a discourse like it, that is, the Noble Qur'an, if they are truthful. These two ayahs, like the previous ones, refer to the manifest truth and its denial by the disbelievers, who used to say that the Noble Qur'an has been forged by the Prophet and not revealed to him by God Almighty. This is indicative of their lack of faith. They were told that they are Arabs like the Prophet, and as the Noble Quran is in eloquent Arabic, they can make attempts and try to produce the like of it, but they cannot. Even if all of their scholars get together, since these are the revealed words of the Almighty Creator, and therefore matchless and unparalleled. From these ayahs, we learn that, number 1, it is obstinacy and intransigence that clouds reasoning and leads to denial of truth and wild accusations against the prophets and truthful persons. Number 2, the Noble Quran as the revealed word of God Almighty is the manifest miracle entrusted to the Prophet of Islam, and therefore inimitable. And number 3, if the intransigent deniers of truth do not believe in the divinity of the Noble Quran, they can get together and assemble their leading scholars to try to produce the like of it, but they cannot write even a page matching its flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom. Now we listen to ayahs 35 and 36 of Surah Tur in conclusion of this week's episode.
أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ أَمْ هُمُ الْخَالِقُونَ أَمْ خَلَقُوا السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ بَلْ لَا يُوقِنُونَ
Were they created from nothing, or are they their own creators? Did they create the heavens and the earth? Rather, they have no certainty. Through these ayahs, God Almighty raises a number of questions in order to awaken the dormant conscience of the disbelievers by presenting the most significant philosophical discussions in the simplest form of expression. Since the fundamental rule of all sciences is that there is no effect if there is no cause. In other words, nothing can come into being out of nothing or by itself. These two blessed ayahs present two assumptions. Firstly, is the human race created for a cause or without it? And secondly, is it possible that mankind is able to create itself? Both assumptions fail to stand against reason, since human beings are a phenomena, and every phenomenon is in need of a cause. Furthermore, mankind, which did not exist before, cannot cause its own existence. As reflected in Ayah 36, the polytheists were aware that God is the creator of them, the heavens and the earth. It is reiterated elsewhere in the Noble Quran that if the polytheists were asked concerning the creator of the heavens and the earth, they would rely that God is the creator. Thus, the main question presented in these ayahs is, why do you not believe in divine guidance instead of disobeying the prophets? The answer is simple. The intransigent disbelievers are not responding to the bidding of their own reason out of their vile disposition of mind and pursuit of vain desires, thereby failing to attain certitude regarding the omniscient and omnipotent Creator. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. The Quran raises certain questions to open the minds of human beings so that they ponder upon facts and realities in a rational manner in order to refrain from obstinacy against truth. Number 2. Our intellect will help us when we are in pursuit of truth and not of vain desires or evil intentions. Number 3. Mankind is neither the creator of itself nor the creator of the world of existence. And number 4. Pondering on one's own self and the world around leads to God and certainty.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Dispel the police, crime, sentencing, and courts bill. If passed through Parliament, the bill will give more power to the police to shut down demonstrations and protesters, could even face prison, which could make peaceful protests and marches a thing of the past. Why did the UK Home Secretary suggest such a bill in the first place? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this bill represents a massive assault on civil liberties and other aspects of this bill, which have been called a violation of human rights.
Soon, this might be illegal in the UK. Holding a banner, beating a drum, and raising your voice in protest. The government's controversial police, crime, sentencing, and courts bill is currently being debated at the House of Lords. If passed, any non-violent public assembly could be snuffed out.
There is a sense of impending doom. People here fear an Orwellian scenario in which democracy as they know it, although flawed, will become a thing of the past.
The new police powers would set conditions on the duration of protests, noise levels and locations. The British feel the walls are closing in on them, manifesting in more than just this bill.
We've got the worst poverty in Europe, we're most of us unequal country in Europe, and We have one of the highest death rates from COVID in Europe as a result. Its treatment of migrants is absolutely appalling.
These are the citizens of the UK saying, we want to, we demand that we live in a free country. We are all here to defend ourselves, our rights, and journalists and publishers like Julian Assange who speak up and tell us what our governments are doing.
The bill also proposes to introduce new laws that penalize stopping on private and public land without authorization. This would have the effect of criminalizing the way of life of Gypsy, Roma and Traveller people.
This is an attack on our right to protest. It's an attack on Gypsy, Roma and Travellers people's right to live, where they've lived in their way of living for like time immemorial. We're seeing more stringent rules, more brutal rules being brought in, more strong policing powers, not just here, but around the world. We're seeing the Zionists upping the ante on the Palestinian people.
All of our struggles are connected, and we're representing the Arab people, and representing the fight against the state and against people's ability to speak against the state is crucial wherever we are.
The Tory government is fishing in murky waters, taking advantage of distractions like the pandemic to push through draconian laws like the police bill and the borders and nationality bill. But the people out on London's streets say they have the government sussed and won't stand for it. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, first we have human rights activist and campaigner Natalie Sprecher joining us from Jersey, Channel Islands. Also joining us, former British MP Chris Williamson, who joins us from Derby, the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Looking at those scenes in those protests were pretty telling. So I'm going to start with you, Natalie Sprecher, if I may. It's called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, huge piece of legislation covering many aspects of the UK criminal justice system. Perhaps you can tell us what the controversial aspects of it are.
Well, I would say that there's probably too many to mention this evening. I mean, obviously, in effect, it outlaws protest. We see the targeting of minority groups. The legislation that will impact the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, which we need to remember is one of the most discriminated communities within the UK, not just in recent years, but actually since medieval times. And I think when we talk about the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, it's important to remember them in the context more widely of Europe, and how alongside the Jews they were the only other people that were identified as a group for extermination. And I think it's really important to remind people of that as we think about how this bill will impact them. But there's lots of other things. As per usual, we see very ambiguous language used about the outlawing of people attaching themselves to things and to people. But what does attach mean? Does it mean just when you observe people locking themselves in, as you quite often see at arms factories and arms fairs? Or does it also possibly mean people linking arms? So I think that there's numerous aspects of this bill, and actually amendments that I'm not even aware of as yet, of course, which have been added since before it went into the House of the Lords. So I think it's deeply concerning legislation and violates our human and civil rights on all levels.
Sure. Chris Williamson, I'm wondering what the thinking behind this was. I'm not sure if you can answer this, but you know, was it something that they actually looked at to initially target certain segments of the British society, perhaps? For example, the ones who come out and protest, for example, the Roma, for example, minorities. Is that the approach, perhaps, that was used? Because it sure looks that way. And leading to the question, which seems to be the most controversial one, and that is to ban marches and demonstrations because they believe that it might seriously, and I don't know if I read this correctly, seriously disruptive, including being too noisy?
Well, I mean, I think the neoliberal capitalist system in this country is broken down. It isn't working, and people are fed up and are increasingly wanting to express their concerns about the way democracy operates in this country. We have a climate catastrophe on the horizon. People are rightly concerned about that. The government isn't acting swiftly enough to deal with that. We see racism and bigotry increasing in this country. We've seen the emergence of the Black Lives Matter campaigners. And obviously this is send a shiver down the spine, it seems to me, of the establishment, because people are flexing their muscles. They are using the democratic right to demonstrate and to put pressure on the government. And it seems to me that this is an attempt to squash protest and to, you know, prevent these sort of inconvenient truths being highlighted on the streets. And this is a very dangerous and slippery slope, it seems to me, when we're talking about potentially jailing people for, you know, up to a year because, you know, they're protesting and you know, police don't like the noise or the route that they wish to take on a march, for example. And I think the other proposition, to potentially jail people for 10 years for defacing or damaging memorials. I mean, we saw this last year or the year before, I think it was, where a slave trader who'd been venerated in Bristol had this statue torn down and thrown into the river. And obviously people are rightly upset and concerned about the way in which Britain's imperialist past is actually you know, promoted and exalted. And it seems to me people have an absolute right to challenge that. And the government are seeking to prevent this and to clamp down in the most repressive way possible. I mean, this is reminiscent of a tin pot dictatorship, not the country which is supposed to pride itself on democracy.
Sure, but Priti Patel seems to think that this is okay, and I'm wondering what you would tell her, Natalie Strecker, when she says, yes, peaceful protest remains a cornerstone of democracy, but argues that there has been a significant change in protest tactics. So she's coming in on protest tactics through that angle, in which she says protesters are exploiting gaps in the law.
Obviously there's lots of things I would say to Priti Patel, but probably most of them are not appropriate at this moment whilst being interviewed. I mean, I guess what I would say is if we just need to look at our history, you know, if I speak as a female, how was it we gained our rights just to be able to vote and to be seen as equals within society? Was only possible through the tactics that are being used currently today. You know, the women had to take themselves on the streets, take direct action to be noisy. You know, there isn't, the problem is, you know, if we look at the other tactics, quite often you'll have people sit down and sign petitions, but we know that no change really comes without people being noisy. And that's one of our rights. And, you know, I've spoken about women's suffrage, but also the civil rights movement, you know, the movement to end the slave trade. I think that Priti Patel needs, quite often, they'll talk about, you know, in November, near Remembrance Day, the importance of the sacrifices our soldiers, our grandparents made in order to gain our freedoms. They talk about this a lot, and yet, you know, at this very moment, they're looking at removing those freedoms that were fought for. So are they really honouring the sacrifices they make when they're looking at bringing such draconian laws? And listening to what Chris said about a tin pot dictatorship,
You know, I would say Priti Patel is a tin pot dictator. And I think it's not just authoritarian. It's actually fascist that we see ourselves slipping into the UK. It's really good. I would encourage people to look up the Warning Signs of Fascism, which is a Holocaust museum, and it highlights the different steps, and we have ticked pretty much all of those steps now. So it is really frightening times, just as ordinary human beings who want to take a stance for things that are important to us. And what I would add is that this isn't even a left-right issue. It comes down to whether we believe in basic freedom of speech, whether we believe in the protection of our civil liberties and individual liberties.
That's the point that has been made. We're going to talk about that in a broader respect when it comes to the UK, but I can't help but also look at this, Chris Williamson, in terms of some of the not only most colorful protests, but some of the most vociferous and large-scale protests that have taken place in the UK over the years, which has to deal with the issue of Palestine. And I'm wondering, given the close relationship that this government, especially Priti Patel, has with Israel, that do you think that this could be one of the driving forces that maybe led as an incentive to come up with the laws and provisions behind this?
Well, I'm sure that featured in their thinking. I don't think that was the only factor, but I'm sure that certainly was one of them. You're absolutely right. And it's not just Priti Patel, of course, that's very close to the Israeli apartheid regime. I mean, you know, the vast majority of parliamentarians are supporters of the apartheid state of Israel. Half the members of the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is supposed to be the party that stands up for civil rights and democracy and anti-imperialism, and yet around 50% of the Parliamentary Labour Party are members of an organisation called Labour Friends of Israel. So yes, certainly, and I think now, because in this modern age of smartphones and so on, what we're seeing is citizen journalism taking place in Gaza, and you know, young people who have learned good English in the UN schools there are able to use their smartphones and then to upload those images onto the internet, which actually illustrate the absolute barbarity of the Israeli regime and the propaganda that we are relentlessly subjected to in this country and have been, you know, ever since Israel was established back in 1948. Much of the atrocities that they perpetrated were unknown to the British people. Well, that's no longer the case. And the bombardment that we saw against Gaza in the spring of last year saw people coming onto the streets in this country in unprecedented numbers, and not just in the capital either. Up and down the country, small towns and large cities in the provinces, saw people coming onto the street. In my own city of Derby, which is a modest-sized city, it saw the biggest demonstration in Derby's history in support of the Palestinian people. Now, of course, this is something which, you know, the government, it seems to me, are not prepared to tolerate. Sure. And I'm sure that this will be used, if these measures are successfully put onto the statute book, to limit the ability of people to, highlight the atrocities of the Israeli regime and to support the Palestinian people. But of course, it goes much wider than that. And you know, we've seen the Insulate Britain activists in this country who have been drawing attention to the scandal of fuel poverty, with millions of people struggling to heat their homes, having to make desperate choices between eating adequately or heating their homes adequately. And there's all sorts of health conditions. Thousands of people die every single year in this country, in the fifth biggest economy in the world, because they can't afford to heat their homes properly, let alone the impact of climate change is having on the way of life of people, if indeed nothing is done to actually, you know, address that. And so,
sure,
you know, they are taking direct action methods. I mean, and Natalie talked about the role of the suffragettes and the direct action that they engaged in. And
sure,
you know, direct action has an absolute and important role to play in a democracy, and it's through direct action actually that many of the advances that we made in this country in terms of democratic rights for the citizens of Britain has been brought about in the first instance as a consequence of direct action. And
sure,
this is a real attempt to try and, you know, stifle it and prevent it, but I'm sure they won't succeed, and you know, people, it will make people more determined. But what we will see is our prisons filling up.
Okay.
Of course, there's an issue there, because all of our prisons have been privatized, so there's money to be made out of imprisoning people in this country. It's an absolute scandal. The system is completely broken in this country, and people are waking up to that. And regrettably, we've got establishment parties on both sides of the chamber in Parliament who are not really speaking up for the people. So people are taking to the streets to actually make their voices heard. And as I say, this is an attempt to stop them actually having their voices heard and the pressure being applied.
Well, that's the whole issue here, Natalie Strecker. I think our guest there, in a sense, nailed it on the head when Chris Williamson said that this is not going to stop people from coming out. We could talk about what may amount as the protests take place, and then the police make decisions as to whether these protests are following any guidelines or not. But I'd like to take a look at the bigger picture there in the UK when it comes to just freedom, when it comes to the whole notion of democracy, because you in a sense talk about how this is becoming a fascist state, perhaps authoritarian. I think you used the word dictatorship. I know that the UK has, by some accounts, been compared to being a police state. Maybe that also leads the lines that you were speaking about the UK in terms of the freedom being chipped away at. This is a big strike to freedom in the UK. What are the consequences that we're going to see as a result of this? What other areas can you name for us if you can?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's going to impact every area of our life, you know, because if it's, I mean, a lot of this is about whether the police agree for you having a protest or the government. Well, it's if the government agrees with it, then it's not really a protest, is it? It's a parade. And I think it's important to kind of remember that. But, Chris quite rightly said before about the different things that are, you know, society is unravelling as we see the collapsing of capitalism, the neoliberal project, as we see ecological breakdown, escalating. This is going to cause more and more unrest. So in terms of freedoms, if people don't have the right to go out on the streets, then it's going to impact other freedoms, the freedom and the right to life. You know, the right to security and all these other things. I think it's deeply concerning, but also how it will impact education that takes place, you know, the sense of, you know, the personal agency that we have as individuals. I think there are so many ways that this will impact us. And of course, we're focusing on a policing bill, but there are other bills that have been brought in already that signals that we are now living in a police state. So if you look at the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, which in effect means that the police and the intelligence agencies are able to commit any crime against private citizens without exception. There is no without caveat. You know, whereas in the past this used to be, you know, for the ambiguous term national security, this can also be used in terms of protecting the UK economy from harm. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean a trade unionist trying to organise a general strike or to protect, to prevent public disorder? What does that mean? Does it mean, torturing or even killing, you know, somebody who's looking to raise, a subject matter that impacts them? So I think that it's hollowing out our civil liberties, and it's going to impact our freedoms. And in fact, there's probably things that we haven't even anticipated at this moment in time. And one thing I perhaps didn't mention when we're talking about the different aspects of the law is this ASBO, really, that if somebody's been to protests that haven't been approved of, and, you know, two protests, I think it is, in the last 5 years, this bill will prevent them from being not only being able to attend protests, but also being able to encourage people on social media or elsewhere to attend protests.
Right.
It's deeply concerning.
Sure, of course, because they don't want you to spread the word or trying to gather people, whether it's through social media means or otherwise. And you talked about other legislation that's being debated, and I have to ask you about this one because this has raised eyebrows and shocked many, Chris Williamson, and that is the Nationality and Borders Bill, which, among other provisions, it would allow government to strip people of their British citizenship. You know, when you take a look at that, and they can do that without notice, it seems like, what is your impression of that? I mean, you know, when you add up all these different things that are happening in the UK, of laws that are going to be passed or will be passed, it really does come down to perhaps what our guest there, Natalie, has said.
Very controversial, and you'd think, given the scandal of the what happened to the Windrush generation, where we saw people, children who'd lived here all their lives virtually, but didn't have papers and weren't able to necessarily prove that they got British citizenship, were being deported back to the Caribbean. Absolutely outrageous, and this caused huge controversy when it eventually came to light a few years ago now. And yet here we are with this new legislation which is being put through, which is kind of a repetition and actually even worse than potentially what happened to the Windrush generation. And people are right to be fearful about the implication of this. But you know as well, I mean, and you know, Natalie mentioned it, and I can't help but to refer back to the point about the covert human intelligence sources bill, and because that actually, and there was an attempt by the opposition in the House of Commons to exclude, because it gives agents of the state the right to commit criminal conduct. And there was an attempt in the House of Commons to limit that criminal conduct, to prevent it from being used to rape, torture or murder people. That could not be done under the basis of this criminal human intelligence sources legislation. And that was voted down. And so it seems to me the government is essentially therefore giving the green light to murder, rape and torture people. I mean, what, this is unbelievable. What is happening? It's outrageous. And so, yes, I mean, you know, the repressive legislation which is being pushed through and which isn't being resisted sufficiently vigorously enough by the official opposition in the House of Commons, or indeed being reported upon by the corporate media, you know, by the Fourth Estate. They're doing an incredible disservice,
sure,
to the people of this nation. And that's why public protest is so important, to actually raise these issues, because we are being ill-served by the media and by our parliamentarians, who should be there to actually hold the executive, to hold the government to account, to stop these repressive measures being pushed through. You know, Britain used to sort of pride itself on its democratic traditions, on spreading democracy around the world, and yet,
indeed,
here we are in a situation where more and more repressive legislation is being pushed through almost on a kind of a monthly basis now. It's quite shocking, and it's really important that we do everything we can, I think, to mobilize opposition to it.
Sure. Who knows? Maybe next time around we can't even debate this on a media program like this one. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but let me thank both of you, human rights activists and campaigner Natalie Stryker. Thank you so much for your thoughts. And former British MP Chris Williamson there from Derby, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tarve, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us two very, very special guests. On my right, we have Sister Asma. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
And on my left, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam and assalamu alaikum from my end.
Sister Zainab, I've met you before, I've worked with you before, but could you give a brief introduction to about yourself? I mean, who are you? Where have you come from?
I am Zainab Askari. I am from the Indian occupied Kashmir, and I'm like done with masters in linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I came to Iran. It's been 7 years I'm here. I am studying Hausa right now.
Uh-huh. So linguistics, you're going to be dealing with like
the rules of translation, phonetics, syntax, uh-huh, morphology, what we do in like surf and now stuff.
Ah, you're my teacher. And Sister Asma, is it? Where are you from? Who are you?
Well, I am from Iran, and I study English literature.
124,000 prophets have come and gone, and humanity, if you look at it today, if we bear in mind that that many messengers have come for the guidance of the human race, should be much, much better than it is. If anything, when people think about humanity, they think that it's completely gone astray.